Ed Robertson, welcoming you back to TV Confidential Radio Talk Show about television. That will take you back to Walnut Grove this segment as we welcome Mr. Dean Butler. Dean Butler, the actor known around the world to three generations of television viewers as Almanzo Wilder, Laura Ingalls' husband on Little House on the Prairie. We've talked about this before many times on this program, just how difficult it can be for an actor to join the cast of a successful TV series in the middle of that show's run. And while that was not necessarily Dean's experience on Little House on the Prairie, in that he was accepted almost immediately by Michael Landon and the rest of the Little House cast, in some ways it was. Though Dean had acted professionally in front of the camera for more than 6 years by the time he joined the cast of Little House at age 22, he was new to Hollywood and in many ways unschooled in the many nuances of Hollywood, certainly in comparison to the younger cast members of Little House on the Prairie when Dean first joined that show. That made him a bit of an outsider who had to find his way inside as he navigated both his new professional life and his new professional home. Fortunately, Dean found a home on Little House on the Prairie and embraced his fellow cast members as family as much as they embraced him. That is one of the many stories that resonated with me and that will resonate with you as you read Dean's new memoir, Prairie Man, which we'll tell you more about in just a second. Dean has a number of appearances coming up in the weeks and months ahead. We'll tell you about that later on the program as well. In the meantime, we began our conversation by telling Dean, there are several things about your book that resonated with me. One of which is the culture shock, for lack of a better word, of moving to Los Angeles and beginning a new life in Los Angeles after previously living most of your life in the San Francisco Bay Area, and just as important, letting go of some of the built-in biases that people in San Francisco have about L.A., and letting go of that as you navigate the new world. I would say you had an advantage because you did that at age 22, so you're a little more formative. I did that at age 45, but in the chapter where you talk about your first 6 or 7 months here, that spoke to me a lot.
So did you go up in the Bay Area?
I grew up in San Francisco, and I lived in various parts. So your chapter on streets is one of my favorite chapters, by the way, meaning the streets of San Francisco. Dean got his first on-screen credit as an actor, appearing as an extra on the streets of San Francisco. Plus, he had his very first speaking part in the episode of Streets of San Francisco that also marked Michael Douglas's final appearance on that show. But no, I grew up in San Francisco, and I lived in various parts of the East Bay, the North Bay, and I worked in the South Bay for about 5 years. So about the only place I didn't lay down my hat was Piedmont, although I almost bought a house there about 10 years ago, but that's another story. But
that would have been, you would have been, I was just there this last weekend for my 50th high school reunion, and Piedmont has never been more beautiful. I think it's always been beautiful, but when you're living there, you're desensitized to how beautiful it is. And now I go in there and I look at that and say, how fortunate I was to be able to grow up in this incredibly idyllic place.
Well, one of the things, and again, this may seem obvious for people who do not live in the Los Angeles area, but one of the things that jumped out at me is when you talked about the first time you saw a movie in L.A.
Yes.
And how it's different, because it was like this way for me. It's like you really understand for the first time that L.A. is an industry town.
Yeah, I think that when I walked in, it was either the Man Bruin or I think it was probably the Man Bruin Theater, which was, of course, at that time the epicenter for premieres in Los Angeles. And as I said in the book, it became very clear that so many of the people who made the movies on the highest levels lived very close by to this theater. So it was a very natural place for them to come and read the temperature of how a paid audience was reacting to what they had made. And it was the first time in my life that I ever experienced people sitting through credits.
Yeah.
You know, when you're not in that world, it's very easy at the end to stand up and walk out of the theater. And once I was now stepping into this world and seeing that nobody moved as the credits started to roll, I realized then, probably more so than at any other time in the experience when the movie was over, that this was in fact business for these people. And they, the people in the audience, either they were in the credits or they knew people whose names were going to be seen in the credits, and they wanted to honor that work that was done by their colleagues by sitting and watching those credits. And to this day, no matter where I am, we always sit and watch credits. There is no getting up and walking out before the credits are done.
Dean Butler's on the line with us. Dean's book, Prairie Man, My Little House Life and Beyond, is available wherever books are sold through Kensington Books, an imprint of Citadel Press. You can follow Dean Butler at deanbutler.com or on Instagram at @officialdeanbutler. One of the things about your book that not only resonated with me, but I think will resonate with anybody who either changes jobs and comes to a new workplace or changes towns and starts all over again, is even though you are a professional and you know that you're there for a reason, the person in your case, Michael Landon, hired you because he knew you were right for the job, you still got to acclimate yourself to that new situation. And in your case, and you talk about this a lot throughout Prairie Man, the fact that even though you had been working professionally as an actor for several years before you joined the cast of Little House, and even though you had on-camera experience, you were still navigating the world of Hollywood and, more importantly, the nuances of Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much an industry town. Of course, when I came into Los Angeles, there was a very deep stratification between feature films, television, and commercials. That was the pecking order of, you know, where actors were working. And so, and I was hanging around with a group of people, with a group of young actors who were really seriously aspiring to careers on the big screen because they believed that, and I think they were right, although it's changed a lot now, but they believed, the sense was that if people are willing to pay to go see you on the big screen, that's the highest reward that you can get. That's the most prestigious work. Well, now with the advent of, a la carte billing for every conceivable kind of streaming service, so many of us are paying for everything we watch. And I think that reality and the expansion of services like HBO and Netflix, where there is a very high quality of production going on, has really broken down that separation. If people work in what are considered Academy Award nominated projects, they work in Emmy Award related projects, and there's really no separation in terms of the prestige of it now. I just don't think that there is that separation. But at that time, back in the late 1970s, there was definitely this feeling, oh, you're doing a television series, you know, so what, kind of thing, among a lot of people that I was sort of hanging out with at that time. And that was something to deal with, but I also knew very quickly, you know, when Michael Landon went on The Tonight Show before I premiered and brought a scene that I was in, as he always did at the beginning of a new season, brought a clip and talked about the new season of the show, and I was in that clip, and, you know, to see yourself, to be watching television at home and see yourself on The Tonight Show in a clip was just incredibly thrilling to me. It was just, you know, that was, I felt like, oh my God, I've arrived here if I'm going to be seen in that environment. And I loved it and appreciated it and was honored by it. But living in Hollywood, navigating the sort of the ups and downs of a career, I mean, that's something that everyone has to deal with, you know, and I certainly had very high moments and I've had disappointing moments in my time here. But on balance, I look at what has happened with Little House and mean, I just never could have imagined all those years ago that I would be talking about Little House. For me, 45 years later, that this company of people who originated this back in 1974, that we'd all still be talking about it, we'd still be meeting fans, we'd still be introducing the program to new generations of people, and experiencing a level of love and affection coming at all of us that just is just off the charts. It's incredible. And I feel like Little House is unique and special in the world of entertainment because of that. There are certainly shows that engender that kind, but there are not as many of those shows as there is content created. For Little House to still be loved and admired on this very emotional level is just an incredible gift for all of us. It's pretty amazing.
And it speaks to the work that Michael Landon did every day, and it speaks to the work that you and your fellow cast members every day. I mean, it's all a team effort. And we've got one of the members of the Little House team with us on the phone today, Dean Butler. Dean Butler, the actor known around the world. It's Almanzo, right? Did we get that?
Yes.
Almanzo.
We said, and what we should have said was Almanzo, but, you know, Almanzo, potato, tomato.
All right, there you go.
It's all the same.
It's all the same. Dean Butler, the actor known around the world as Almanzo/Almanzo Wilder on Little House on the Prairie. Although some of us, me included, I'll confess, Dean, I mean, I've gotten to know a lot of the Little House family as a result of doing my program. But in the day, when I found out through our mutual friend that you were available to do my show, I mean, he said he played Moondoggy, didn't he? Because I enjoyed the new Gidget, you know, when I was I think of you as Moondoggy, and
very good. From Manly to Moondoggy, that's pretty cool.
Very good. Dean's memoir, Prairie Man: My Life, My Little House Life, and Beyond, is not only the first memoir written by a male cast member of Little House on the Prairie, but gives you insight into Michael Landon, the actor, and the person that you probably haven't read before, as well as the backstory behind the famous on-screen kiss between Almanzo and Laura Ingalls in Dean's first season on Little House, the weirdness that ensued behind the scenes in the weeks leading up to that episode, and how Dean somehow managed to navigate all of that with grace and aplomb. Prairie Man, My Little House Life, and Beyond, available wherever books are sold through Kensington Books and Imprint Citadel Press. You can follow Dean, DeanButler.com, or Official Dean Butler on Instagram. Calendar year 2024 marks the 50th anniversary of the premiere of Little House on television. Matter of fact, Dean is getting ready. Dean is literally packing his bags to leave for an event in Tombstone, Arizona, as we record this conversation. By the time this program airs in September, there will be several other events in the works in locations such as Watertown, Connecticut, Lyles, Tennessee, Branson, Missouri, Mansfield, Missouri, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Corsicana, Texas, and many other cities to come. To find out if Dean is coming to a city near you, DeanButler.com or Official Dean Butler on Instagram. I want to circle back to one thing. You don't say this explicitly in Prairie Man, Dean, but the sense I got is once you learned some of the nuances of your new professional town and your new professional family, I got the sense that you discovered that people in L.A., people in the film industry, are no different than people anywhere else, and that they live by the golden rule.
He who has the gold makes the rule.
I wasn't quite going there, but you got a point.
Well, that's okay. So the golden rule: do unto others as you have to do unto you.
Yes,
that's the golden rule you're referring to.
That is what I'm referring to. Yes.
You know, and I think both spins on the golden rule are accurate.
Yes.
I think that's. One is a reality. The other one, I think, is an aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
What you brought. brought up. I think it does take time to, you know, it takes time to learn both rules, and you have to have experienced the downside of both spins on that rule to really know that it's true. But I think, you know, where we were all concerned, we really were schooled, and I think people who were with the program with Little House earlier than I was from the very beginning, you know, I think they learned a lot of lessons about how to be and survive within the industry from a very savvy cast and crew led by Michael Landon, who understood the ins and outs of Hollywood as well or better than anybody did. That, I mean, he just, because he was an iconic presence. But I think he taught people or encouraged people to be prepared to come in ready to do your work, come in, do your work in a timely way, and move on to the next scene. And he did not encourage or he discouraged overt expressions of ego, insecurity that what everyone has, but he did not tolerate or did not give ground to people who were going to become emotionally distraught or overly needy based on what they were doing. He had no time for that. He wasn't interested in that. And you got the message pretty quickly that that was not going to be tolerated. And I think that lesson, as much as any other lesson, has stuck with me, you know, is that you have to be prepared to do your job, and you have to function as a team player, because television, film, anything, any creative activity is a team.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's doing it by themselves. And I think you certainly see that with filmed entertainment, where you're counting on so many people to do their jobs well in order for an outcome to be good. You have to put your own ego aside a little bit at times, and or not act out on your ego, your fear and anxiety, if you can help it, in order to help the group as a whole proceed forward and do what they're trying to do. And that's true when you're working in front of the camera or behind the camera. It doesn't matter. It's about being on a team. And Michael was very, very strong on that point. And I think, you know, I think of my colleagues who have gone on and done other things. I think everyone got that, and they got that very strongly from him.
And one of the things you talk about specifically, you go back to this several times throughout Prairie Man. Michael left an imprint on you, if I may call him Michael, left an imprint on you in many ways that carries over to your work, throughout your work, and many of the other things you've done in the decades since you last did Little House.
Sure. Well, Michael was Michael was a force of nature, and no one understood what they were trying to do on our set. No one understood what the show was trying to do better than Michael did. He was crystal clear on the vision, and he shared that vision. He led with that vision, and people got in line, and they went with the vision, or, you know, it would be best to probably not continue, because you weren't going to fight that vision. There was no percentage in fighting it at all. And I think the fact that it was, if the show had not been as fantastically successful as it was, there's always room to push back. But when something's really working, as it was, you're not going to push back on anything. You'd be crazy to push back on anything. It's just because the audience is watching it, they're liking it, and they keep coming back for more. And that was, Michael did that. He achieved that for 14 years of Bonanza, 10 seasons of Little House, and I think 7 seasons
of Highway to Heaven.
Yeah. And he was getting ready to do it again.
Yeah.
On another show before he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He just had this incredible Midas touch. Now, he was cast in Bonanza. That was, he had nothing to do with controlling that, although as it went on, I can't help but believe, knowing the force of his personality, that he was asserting himself more and more by the time that was ended. I mean, he had a very clear point of view about what he believed family entertainment was all about, and he really stuck to that. Michael was not interested in demonstrating some massive range as an actor and playing all kinds of different parts and different genres and all that. What Michael was interested in very clearly was identifying an audience, understanding what they wanted, and giving it to them again and again and again. Because he reasoned quite accurately, certainly where television was concerned, that if people liked it, they would come back to it again and again and again. And so he never betrayed that audience. He never took them down a path that they weren't going to, at least that wasn't within. There were episodes that were perhaps more provocative than others, things, but the overall tone of what Michael did from the beginning of his career till the end of his career was the same, and it was very, I believe, very intentionally that way to keep an audience engaged. He was such a singular talent, he was able to do that, and you can aspire to be that kind of singular talent, but I think some of that is just, there's kismet in that to be that kind of talent. I just admire what he achieved, and I certainly had my bumps with Michael, a few bumps through the years of working with him, of maybe not making him happy with a question that I would ask, or failing to follow an instruction that he'd given me, not deliberately failing to, but just, not getting it. And so there were a few tense moments, but overall, Michael was a spectacular person to work with, and anybody who did. I mean, so if you're looking at lessons that I learned, I think you want to be good and decent to the people that you're working with. And that golden rule that you do unto others, it's like, you're going to run into the same people, it's been said for years, that you run into the same people on the way up that you run into on the way down.
That's true.
You're going to meet those people again. And to have been a good and decent person, which is an aspirational thing, and to be aware of how important that is, we all can hope that we have done things that will engender goodwill from the people around us, both on the way up and as on the way down. And so that you can get, there's a little generosity that goes with that. I hope those are the lessons that I learned from Michael. I certainly take them very seriously. He had a passionate commitment to fans. And I think all of us who are a part of Little House recognize how important fans are, and I think we are, as a cast of people, are very responsive to the and respectful of the affection that comes at us from people who love the program, and that came from Michael too. I mean, nothing was more, he would invite people onto the stage, he would take time to sit with people, he'd take pictures, he'd sign autographs, he'd tell stories, when people came onto the stage or came on location, he just really got that. That was a big deal for him. And I think we all came to understand that there was a value in that kind of graciousness. And we try and do that from then to now. We all try and do that.
Dean Butler's on the line with us. Dean Butler, the actor known around the world as Almanzo Wilder on Little House on the Prairie, Moondoggy on The New Gidget, Buffy's dad on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and the producer of the long-running Emmy-nominated NBC Channel talk show, Fear Dig, Dean's memoir, Prairie Man, My Little House Life and Beyond, available wherever books are sold through Kensington Books and imprint of Citadel Press. Dean's going to stay with us in another segment. We hope you'll stay with us as we continue our conversation here on TV Confidential. One more item. Are you starting a company in an emerging market or developing something new? Do you have intellectual property but aren't sure how to protect it? Reach out to our friends at Tectonic Law. They offer rock-solid representation for groundbreaking industries who need help capturing and protecting their full portfolio of intellectual property and intangible assets, including trademark rights, brand assets, copyright rights, publicity rights, and privacy rights. Tech law streamlines the complex intricacies of intellectual property and business law in easy-to-understand terms that will help you and your company form a concrete plan of action to secure and protect the value of your brand and your creative work product. Tectonic Law is licensed to practice throughout the state of California. They also practice before such tribunals as the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and the Internet Corporation for assigned names and numbers. Go to tectoniclaw.com, tectoniclaw.com, to learn more about how Tectonic Law can help your business thrive. Tectoniclaw.com, rock solid representation for groundbreaking industries.
Buying or selling a home can be one of the most stressful things we'll ever do in life, but it doesn't have to be. And no one knows better than our friends at Front Porch Realty. Their community of realtors serving the Northern Bay Area of California that cares about their clients as individuals first and foremost. Whether you're a first-time buyer or looking to lease or sell your property in the Bay Area, Front Porch Realty will help you through this important transition by providing you with the right information for your situation while lessening the pain. They also work with a network of realtors throughout California who provide the same high caliber of customer service. Call Karen Strain at 415-886-7411 for a realtor referral near you. You can also visit their website, frontporchrealtygroup.com, for more information on the services they provide, including upcoming workshops and seminars. For more information, call Karen Strain at 415-886-7411 or visit frontporchrealtygroup.com. Front Porch Realty. They'll find a solution that works best for you.
If you're a fan of Mike Connors, if you're a fan of Mannix, be sure to check out Mike Connors, A Life of Integrity in Film and Television by Bill Taylor, an excellent new book that not only tells you everything you want to know about the life and career of Mike Connors, but captures the utter decency of Mike Connors, the person. Mike Connors, A Life of Integrity in Film and Television, available now wherever books are sold through our friends at Bear Manor Media. You can also find it at Amazon.com, BarnesNoble.com, wherever books are sold online. Ed Roberts is a reminder that Walter Koenig will join us at the top of the hour. We hope you stay tuned for that. In the meantime, Dean Butler's on the line with us. Dean Butler, the actor known around the world as Almanzo Wilder on Little House on the Prairie, Moondoggy on the new Gidget, Buffy's dad on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and the producer of the long-running Emmy-nominated NBC Channel talk show, Be Her Dee, Dean's memoir, Prairie Man, My Little House Life and Beyond, available wherever books are sold through Kensington Books and Imprint of Citadel Press. You can follow Dean, DeanButler.com, official Dean Butler on Instagram. We do have a couple of people in common besides Harlan Bull and besides some of the Little House actresses that I've had a chance to talk to on this program, one of whom is William Shallert, your co-star on the new Gidget, and the other is Susan McCrae, the casting director on Little House, and the second most important person in your life at the time you joined that show.
Yeah, no, there's no question. Susan was the gatekeeper. You know, anybody who was coming on the program had to go through, or was going to be considered for the program, had to go through Susan's office. Susan had a very clear sense of what Michael was looking for. You know, we've had conversations about this. I mean, Susan was trying to populate a community, this little community of Walnut Grove, and she wanted to populate it with people who would fit in to that little world and in a way that was going to honor the program and what it represented. So, you know, if it hadn't worked with Susan coming in the door, we wouldn't be having any of this conversation. you know, Susan did a great job populating the show, and by the time, you know, Michael met people coming in for parts, she really nailed it down to two or three, four people maybe for him to consider, and then he made his choices, and I'm incredibly grateful that he chose me for this particular part, because it's been, you know, it's been the great thing for my life. William Shallert guested on Little House. He played a minister on Little House. He may have guested more than once, but I'm aware of him during my time on the show. He came in as a guest star. And of course, I'd watched him. You know, we'd all watched him on the Patty Duke show. Mm-hmm. And so many things that he did. A wonderful episode of Star Trek that he did.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was just, when I saw William Shatner on the call sheet and met him, I mean, he was a lovely guy. And what's so cool about William Shatner is he had this persona. He brought a very particular thing to his work, but he also had, when it was appropriate, he could bring it to his work. He was a very buttoned-up guy mm-hmm. in his persona on television and in the work that he did. But Bill could be a very silly guy.
Yes.
He had a wonderful, silly, quirky sense of humor, and he had a great laugh. And I know that Karen Richmond, who was on Gidget, loved working with Bill, and Bill could tease her in this really wonderful way. I mean, he'd had some very significant experiences working with young actresses in lead positions in shows. Certainly with Patty Duke, he did it there, and I've sure countless others. Was he Nancy Drew's father?
He was Nancy Drew's dad on the Nancy Drew mysteries in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he radiated a kind of stability and a goodness about him, and he certainly brought that to the work we did together on the new Gidget. And he was just a ton of fun. He really was. We miss him. You know, we miss him. We did events with him for years during the show and after the show was over. And Bill, and of course, Bill would have been president of the Screen Actors Guild, mm-hmm. which is no small achievement.
Mm-hmm.
My castmate Melissa Gilbert went on to be president of the Screen Actors Guild some years later. I mean, boy, to be able to be a person, as Bill was and as Melissa was, who could try and navigate the wants and needs of a group of highly creative people with very strong senses of themselves and what they believed, to navigate that and try and find common ground with people. You know, those are skills that Melissa has, and those are definitely skills that Bill Shatner had, working with, you know, as president of the Screen Actors Guild. And he was awesome.
I'm looking at the clock because I know our time is limited. As we say, Dean is getting ready to hop on a plane today as we're calling him today. So we're very, very gracious that he's spending part of his day with us. Just before we go, and I want to circle back to something that you – this is if you have a recurring theme in your book, and you have more than one, but the one that jumps out, and it touches on our conversation about our mutual friend Susan McCrae. You talk about how not only how important casting directors are in the life of any actor, particularly a young actor starting the craft, but just in general. I mean, about how casting directors are trained to have unerring instincts about everything.
Yeah, when an actor walks in the room for an audition, I think that actors are bringing their whole lives in the door with them, and they may not talk about their whole lives during the course of a meeting, but as casting directors, as we as people do, we intuit a lot about the people we meet very, very quickly. And casting directors not only have to intuit it for themselves, they, you know, as people, they have a reaction to individuals that they meet, but they also have to have that reaction in the interest of the program that they're casting, to make decisions about will this person fit into this world that I'm responsible for populating with actors of all ages and descriptions. And if Susan did that really, really well. And you know, look, we're always happy with the you're always happy with the casting directors that like you, and you sort of find what the casting directors that maybe you're not as successful with. But you know, it's easy to take it personally when it doesn't go well, and take it personally when it does go well. But it's really not. I mean, yes, it is personal because it's intuitive. But the person who's looking at you and making these judgments is looking at you in the context of an overall, of a thing that's not about their relationship with you. It's about your potential relationship as an actor in the program or the movie or the play or whatever it is that they are casting. And they have a huge responsibility to put people in those situations who they have to believe are going to succeed in those situations.
Dean's memoir, Prairie Man, My Little House Life and Beyond, available wherever books are sold through Kensington Books and imprint of Citadel Press. You can follow Dean, deanbutler.com, official Dean Butler on Instagram. Walter Koenig will join us when we come back for hour number two of TV Confidential. Please stay with us. One more item. Are you starting a company in an emerging market or developing something new? Do you have intellectual property but aren't sure how to protect it? Reach out to our friends at Tectonic Law. They offer rock-solid representation for groundbreaking industries who need help capturing and protecting their full portfolio of intellectual property and intangible assets, including trademark rights, brand assets, copyright rights, publicity rights, and privacy rights. Tectonic Law streamlines the complex intricacies of intellectual property and business law in easy-to-understand terms that will help you and your company form a concrete plan of action to secure and protect the value of your brand and your creative work product. Tectonic Law is licensed to practice throughout the state of California. They also practice before such tribunals as the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and the Internet Corporation for assigned names and numbers. Go to tectoniclaw.com, tectoniclaw.com, to learn more about how Tectonic Law can help your business thrive. Tectoniclaw.com. Rock solid representation for groundbreaking industries.
Buying or selling a home can be one of the most stressful things we'll ever do in life, but it doesn't have to be. And no one knows better than our friends at Front Porch Realty. Their community of realtors serving the Northern Bay Area of California that cares about their clients as individuals first and foremost. Whether you're a first-time buyer or looking to lease or sell your property in the Bay Area, Front Porch Realty will help you through this important transition by providing you with the right information for your situation while lessening the pain. They also work with a network of realtors throughout California who provide the same high caliber of customer service. Call Karen Strain at 415-886-7411 for a realtor referral near you. You can also visit their website, frontporchrealtygroup.com, for more information on the services they provide, including upcoming workshops and seminars. For more information, call Karen Strain at 415-886-7411 or visit frontporchrealtygroup.com. Front Porch Realty. They'll find the solution that works best for you.
If you're a fan of Mike Connors, if you're a fan of Mannix, be sure to check out Mike Connors, A Life of Integrity in Film and Television by Bill Taylor, an excellent new book that not only tells you everything you want to know about the life and career of Mike Connors, but captures the utter decency of Mike Connors, the person. Mike Connors, A Life of Integrity in Film and Television, available now wherever books are sold through our friends at Bear Manor Media. You can also find it Amazon.com, BarnesNoble.com, wherever books are sold online. Ed Robertson, welcoming you back to TV Confidential Radio Talk Show about television. That is very happy to welcome back our friend Walter Koenig. Walter Koenig, the actor known around the world as Mr. Chekhov on the original Star Trek, and Alfred Bester on Babylon 5. Walter's memoir, Beaming Up and Getting Off, Life Before and Beyond Star Trek, is a delightfully candid, often poignant, and very insightful read that walks you through his growing up years as the son of Russian immigrants in 1940s Manhattan, his formative years as an actor with the Neighborhood Playhouse in New York, his lifelong love of the theater, and his deep appreciation of the many opportunities that Star Trek continues to give him. Beaming Up and Getting Off, Life Before and Beyond Star Trek, available in hardcover and as an ebook through Jacobs Brown Media Group. Also with us is our friend Chuck Harder. Chuck Harder, television historian, music historian, author of such books as Mr. Novak and acclaimed television series. We began our conversation by telling Walter, let's start by talking about your experience with the Neighborhood Playhouse in New York, which is one of the most prestigious acting schools in the country. A lot of actors got their start at the Neighborhood Playhouse. And if I remember correctly, you say in your book, Beaming Up and Getting Off, Walter, that your years at the Neighborhood Playhouse were the only time you really enjoyed being in school.
Well, that's true, particularly the first year. The first year was totally devoted to everything to do with the drama medium. I mean, I had voice classes, and I had speech classes, and I had dance classes with some famous dancers, Martha Graham, Pearl Lang, and I was really terrible. I mean, that wasn't my forte, but I loved going to school every day. There was no pressure other than to do well in the class. The first year, we did not showcase. We just did classwork. And I didn't have to worry about getting hired for anything. I just came to class every day and did the best I could and had some very perceptive people conducting classes and felt very good about the whole experience. I also had some interesting people to work with who became movie stars, Chris Lloyd and James Caan and Dabney Coleman, Jessica Walter, Brenda Vaccaro, Elizabeth Ashley. All ended up doing motion pictures and doing leads and becoming well-recognized. So that was a terrific, the first year was really terrific. The second year we began to showcase. We invited agents and casting directors in to see our work. And that there was a little bit more pressure involved as a consequence of that. But still, it was a terrific experience, and I'm so grateful for my teacher at UCLA. I graduated from UCLA prior to going to the Neighborhood Playhouse, and I took one acting class, and the instructor's name was Art Friedman, and he was my initial supporter, and he convinced me to go to drama school as opposed to going to graduate school in psychology. I graduated with a degree in psychology. But it was the best move I made. I wrote the letter to the drama school Neighborhood Playhouse. They accepted me, and then I had, you know, two really terrific years there.
It sounds like there was a true esprit de corps among you and your fellow actors at the time you were at the Neighborhood Playhouse.
There was. We all got along quite well. Chris, for example, Chris Lloyd and I were really, really close. And he thought I was funny. I mean, he used to laugh at what I did. But yeah, I invited me to his country home, and our relationship continued after we graduated for a while. I came out first. I came out here to do a movie, here being L.A., with Burt Lancaster and Shelley Winters. It didn't happen. And that's, you know, that's the baptism of fire. You learn very quickly that most things don't happen.
Yeah.
But he followed me out, and then Dabney came out and Jimmy Caan came out, and we hung out a little bit. We didn't hang out a great deal, but we hung out together for a while. In fact, I ended up playing opposite Jimmy Caan in an episode of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour. He played the good guy, and I played the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a delightful experience. I thoroughly enjoyed working with him.
If I remember correctly, you learned something about attitude or carrying yourself as a performer as a result of working with James Caan.
Well, we went to lunch one day. I think this is what you're referring to. We went to lunch one day at Universal, and we were working on the Hitchcock. And we stepped out of the door on our way back to the soundstage. And the AD was frantically yelling, "Come on, come on, we need you, hurry up." And I started to run, and Caan grabbed me and said, "Stars don't run." It worked for him. I'm not sure it worked for me.
Well, it's perception. If you think of yourself as a star, then you carry yourself that way.
Yeah. I don't think I ever thought of myself as a star. Not when I had Bill Shatner to totally ignore me.
Well, we'll get to that in due time. I mean,
I'm not going to get bitter about it. At this late stage in my life, I look at it with a different perspective. I see the logic in the relationship, and I see the humor as well. So I'm not a bitter old. I'm an old guy, but I'm not a bitter old guy.
No. And I dare say, with regard to Shatner, and this is something you talk about quite a bit. When you recall your experience with Shatner in your book, Beaming Up and Getting Off, Walter, is that you have great insight into what makes him tick because you worked very closely with him on a number of times. And you present him, I mean, look, you present the good and you present the bad, but you do both with perspective and understanding and I dare say empathy for him.
Well, you know, he's had an extraordinary career, and that has got to be acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
And just to come down on him as a personality, I don't think is fair. I mean, I think there's some. I think, you know, there are things that he could have done better.
Mm-hmm.
As a person, but you have to acknowledge his talent and the fact that he carried that show. Along with Leonard, and we might not have had a third season had it been not for Bill.
Mm-hmm.
So I give him all the credit for his work and for his industry and for his influence on keeping us on the air.
Walter Koenig is our guest today. Walter Koenig, the actor known around the world as Chekhov on Star Trek, the original series, and the first six Star Trek movies, and Alfred Bester on Babylon 5. Walter's memoir, Beaming Up and Getting Off, Life Before and Beyond Star Trek, available in hardcover and as an ebook through our friends at Jacobs Brown Media Group. Chuck, you've got a few questions for Walter, don't you?
Yeah, hi, Walter.
Hi.
Nice to see you. We did a bunch of lunches over on Ventura. I'm the guy who called you about Mr. Novak. And
Chuck.
Yeah, it's me.
Of course.
Yeah, it's me. And in fact,
I didn't think it could be the same Chuck.
No, well, it is. It is.
We met at. We met at a restaurant on Van Nuys.
Several times.
Yeah,
but,
many times. And you know something? I just happened to go over the book that you wrote again.
Oh.
I had never read it thoroughly. I can't say that I've read every page this time, but I found all of the acknowledgments of me.
Mm-hmm.
and thoroughly enjoyed that. And remembered what a delightful time I had with Mr. Novak. I did three different characters. It was a far less sophisticated time when you could get away with coming back three seasons in a row.
Mm-hmm.
Playing different characters. I don't think you could do that today, but I played three really different characters. I played a rabble-rouser who took the student body out on strike. I played the second role in a show where we beat up a teacher, and I get to confess my sins to Dean Jagger. And I played the Russian student, the affecting Russian student, in The Boy Without a Country. So it was terrific opportunities for me. I thoroughly enjoyed doing all those parts. And James Franciscus and Dean Jagger, they were all very professional. You know, they weren't buddy-buddy, but they were very professional, and I certainly had a good time doing that.
You mentioned something that's very true today. I mean, in some ways, the TV audience is very literal. These days, if you do one episode of NCIS, and that show runs for 15 years, the casting people won't bring you back because they say, well, you already did one, and the audience will remember you for that. Whereas back in the 60s and, you know, 70s, your formative years as a performer, casting people thought differently. And I think part of it was seasons were longer, And an episode that aired in the first season of Mr. Novak may not necessarily have been repeated during the summer. And so when you appeared again in the second season, for example, the audiences who watched you in the second season may not have remembered the show you did in the first year, or may have missed it when it aired originally. And so that it was a good time to be an actor in that respect, because there are a lot of anthology type of shows, and therefore a lot of opportunities for working actors like you to find work in television and hone your craft.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad Chuck is there, because I have a question that came up for me when I was rereading his book. Alan Hunt, who was a good friend of mine and who played on Mr. Novak several times. Chuck, in the episode that he died as a football player, when he was...
Yes.
Did he come back after that as another character?
I don't think so. I think that was his final run in the timeline. So, no. He was very good, too.
Chris, I didn't get to see that. But I know he did it, and then I was curious, because I know he did several... There were actors who were brought back five and six times. I think Timmy Riddick was brought back several times. In any case, yeah, I was curious about that. I was curious about whether or not they resurrected him from the dead.
No, he died on the football field and went off to football heaven.
Beaming up and getting off, Life Before and Beyond Star Trek, Walter Koenig's memoir, available hardcover and as an ebook through Jacobs Brown Media Group. I'm going off memory, but while we're on the subject of Mr. Novak, if I remember correctly, there's sort of a through line between your work on Mr. Novak and how you ended up being cast on Star Trek.
Yeah, it's kind of an ironic story, and is really is an illustration of how capricious this industry is.
Mm-hmm.
There's not necessarily any logic to how one advances through one's career. You can start out hot and then suddenly be anonymous. Or you can toil in at the lower end of things for years and years and never achieve any success,
mm-hmm.
and never achieve this, you know, prominence, even if you are very talented. And I'm thinking of several actors that I know that you never heard of because they never got beyond, you know, small theater productions.
Yeah.
Yet they were very talented. So yeah, that particular story is really illustrative of how bizarre this industry can be, and how sometimes you catch a break when you least expect it, and other times, for no good reason, you never achieve the success you should have. Very quickly, Joe DiAgusta, who was the casting director on Mr. Novak, was one of the casting directors. He and I met.
Beaming Up and Getting Off, available hardcover and as an ebook through Jacobs Brown Media Group. Chuck Harder's book, Mr. Novak, an acclaimed television series, available through our friends at Bear Manor Media. Walter Koenig will be back next week for part two of our conversation. He'll share more stories from his career in movies, stage, and television. In the meantime, Matt Robertson, Beth Tony Figueroa, and Donna Allen, Phil Grace, Greg Gerbar, and Susan Silver, thank you so much for listening. Stay healthy, stay safe. We'll talk to you next time on TV
Bot. Join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. for my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Bott, or North State Now, the first Thursday update right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.